Hi, Kathy.
Hey, how you doing, Ryan?
Good. How are you and where are you?
I am actually home, and that is so rare that it feels like I'm on vacation.
And where is home for you?
Home is Philadelphia, Pennsylvania.
Oh, so we have a cross-state podcast today. I'm calling in from Pittsburgh. We have Kathy in Philadelphia. For our listeners who are just joining us, we're trying something a little bit new on Remaking Tomorrow. As you can probably hear, we have a guest host. Her name is Kathy Hirsch-Pasek, and if you've ever listened to our show before, you probably know who Kathy is. She was with us in season 5 to talk about making everyday spaces more playful. Likewise, if you've read When You Wonder, You're Learning, the book that I co-authored with Greg Bear, you've met Kathy, or at least you've met her work, because we're so heavily influenced by Kathy's book, Becoming Brilliant, which she wrote with her longtime collaborator, Roberta Golenkoff. And she's the Stanley and Deborah Lefkowitz Professor of Psychology at Temple University, where she directs the Infant Language Laboratory. Kathy's a fellow at the Brookings Institution, the American Psychological Association, the American Educational Research Society, and lots of other places. We could not ask for a better guest host on this program. And by the way, her latest book, Making Schools Work, Bringing the Science of Learning to Joyful Classroom Practice, is the first education book co-written with teachers, administrators, and scientists, something that lots of our listeners would surely be interested in. Kathy, what are we here to talk about today?
Well, first, I just want to thank you for that incredible introduction. Wow, I'm trying to figure out who you asked. I cannot tell you how excited I am today to welcome one of the most creative people on the planet, and that is my dear friend, Susan Meg Salmon, who wrote a very influential book that made it onto the New York Times bestseller list and has had rave reviews, and it's called Your Brain on Art. Yes, at this time, when they are taking arts out of the school, Susan is telling us how you have brain growth that comes from participating in music and visual arts and from dance. And guess what? I think she's even going to tell us that you live longer when you engage in the arts than when you don't. So we couldn't have a better guest on this show than Susan Meg Salmon.
Susan, welcome to Remaking Tomorrow. We're so happy to have you here.
I'm thrilled. My energy just jumped 10 points. So
and Kathy noted that you're one of the most creative people on the planet.
True. It's
you
true.
Are the founder, the executive director of the International Arts and Mind Lab Center for Applied Neuroaesthetics at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine, where you're also a faculty member in the Department of Neurology. You are co-director of something called the Neuro Arts Blueprint, which we're going to get into in a little bit. So much of your work, you know, for more than 40 years has incorporated art, has incorporated psychology and health and well-being. Can you just tell us, how did you get interested in this? What were your early experiences with art? Were you always a creative person, always an art lover?
I grew up in a family of makers, and I saw myself more as a craft person than an art person. And in hindsight, I think our family just lived a very artful life. We sang, we danced, we cooked together. My mom was a big sewer. My grandmother was a quilter and knitter. And, you know, we always were engaged in these making and beholding experiences. So it was very normal for me. We didn't name it the arts. You know, we went to museums, we went to gardens. We just did these things as part of our rituals. But when I was 12, I'm a twin. My sister's name is Sandra. She had a farming accident and almost lost her leg. And we now know that traumatic experiences shut down a part of the brain called the BRCA area, where you literally can't find words. And so my sister shut down completely. As a twin, we could no longer have that telepathic relationship that we had always had. I couldn't feel her, and she couldn't feel herself. And so my mom suggested that she start to draw. And what started to come out were these symbols and metaphors of loss and fear and grief and terror. And I was able to, through her images, understand what she was trying to express that she couldn't bring out. So it was stuck inside of her. And there wasn't the word creative arts therapy then. There wasn't, you know, all of this work that we now know now. But I was able to find my sister, and she was able to find herself. And I think it was that very formative experience that helped me understand that there are many ways that we share ourselves, and speaking might be the least effective. And so I just became so attuned to how people shared themselves through these aesthetic experiences.
Susan, you took that story and that became the germ for a whole field that you've created. And I'm amazed that, first of all, it's very rare that somebody helps to create a field. But I think you are really one of the people who created NeuroArts. And I wonder if you'd say just a little bit about that.
Sure. In 2007, we had a donor at Hopkins who wanted to give money to the School of Medicine. Her name is Marilyn Peterson. And she's told the dean of the School of Medicine that the arts could save us. And she wanted some of that money to be invested in understanding how the arts affect our brains and bodies. And I was at the time in the School of Education. My work had been in arts and learning and in family engagement and play, working with you, Kathy, for a number of years. And we'd done all kinds of work together. But the School of Med invited me to meet the family. And as soon as she said that, I said, you're right. And I don't know how we're going to do it, but let's try to figure out what do we know, what do we need to know, and how do we translate that research into practice and scale it. You know, we didn't set out to build a field, but one thing led to another. And it was very clear that there was so much shovel-ready research in sensory systems and cognitive science and music cognition. And we just went at it. And so I really attribute the ability to think about this to a philanthropist and a visionary who said, let's figure this out. You know, fast forward now, we're 2 years into an implementation plan where we're looking at policy at the federal level, in healthcare, in education, in every sector of society, the arts are being used to help really amplify humanity, whether that's mental health, physical health, learning, community engagement, you know, you name it, flourishing. You know, we don't just want to survive, we want to flourish.
Susan, I'm amazed that, gosh knows, there are a lot of silos where you found all of this research. When I read your book, I felt like I was farming in a lot of different places around the world and putting it in together as a beautiful salad. And I'm just wondering if you can help me out. Like, give me a few stories that make it like incredibly real so I can see what the NeuroArts can do for people.
Sure. Let's start by thinking about physical pain. You know, that chronic pain is ubiquitous. It's the most treated kind of issue in healthcare. And that makes sense because there are so many different kinds of pain. And what we saw in looking at chronic pain was that virtual reality helped with headaches. Dancing helped with headaches. We also saw that when you couldn't identify where pain was coming from, visual arts drawing your pain, you were able to understand whether it was psychological or physiological. There are virtual reality programs that help with changing bandages for burn victims. We started to see that you were able to relieve pain through a number of other kinds of somatic tapping and humming and engaging the parasympathetic nervous system and lowering stress, which, you know, stress amplifies pain. It sort of is like this residual trigger that keeps re-triggering the pain and the anxiety. And you could move that into looking at something around palliative care. So many of us live with chronic illness all the time, and it's not going to be cured, but you can have symptom relief. And that's just physical health. We know that when you draw for about 40 minutes or do some kind of collage or clay work or visual art, cortisol lowers as much as 25%. And the kicker is you don't have to be good at it. And so to have great impact, you don't have to have an art background. You don't have to have a skill coming to it. It's this act of repetitive motion using the touch receptors in your fingers that amplify neurotransmitters like serotonin and dopamine and oxytocin. So we know that there are over 600 mechanisms in the body that have been identified that are related to arts and aesthetic experiences that back map to all of these different issues that we as individuals face, whether they're mental health or learning.
So Susan, are you telling me I can scribble and it works?
You know you can. You know you can. Okay, doodle.
Doodling. Doodle. I just want to doodle.
You are a doodler. You have a book about it. Doodling helps you retain information, absorb information, better than non-doodlers. So, you know, everybody's hand that got slapped because they were doodling, you know, shame on the slapper, because those are the folks that are really capturing information in a way that you're not able to capture without that sort of repetitive movement. You know, we use about 5% of our conscious minds. The rest is unconscious. And so we don't understand the latent capacities of our brains. You know, this ancient part of the brain of emotion is what the arts and aesthetic experiences really ignite. And emotion is what lays down the memory.
Susan, a moment ago, Kathy mentioned your book, which came out in 2023. It's called Your Brain on Art, How the Arts Transform Us, which you co-wrote with Ivy Ross. And it's a wonderful book that shares a lot of this research, a lot of research that I think would be surprising even to art lovers. And another thing I really appreciated is that you interview lots and lots of people about how the arts have transformed them, including, I have to say, one of my musical heroes, David Byrne. I'm wondering if you could tell us about some of the folks you interviewed, some of the folks who stand out now, you know, more than a year after publication.
We interviewed over 120 people, and we interviewed, as you said, artists, people that practice using the arts, researchers, and a lot of people with lived experience. And David's extraordinary, right? He is an incredible artist. And with David, what he really lifted up was synchronicity and how he believes that the beat of our lives really bring us together. And so he did something called Social Distance Dance Club right at the end of COVID, where he created 6-foot circles. This was so fascinating because he pointed out that we sing in choirs together, we synchronize together in churches, we march together in the military. There are these moments where we synchronize, but dance and music, we synchronize with each other automatically. So even 6 feet apart, we found each other's vibration and synchronicity, and our brains literally get into the same brainwave. So he's just and continues to do this amazing work around how the arts really create community. And I think right now in the world, more than ever, we need community. And in that same chapter, Wilson, who we were really honored to talk with right before his passing, talked about the fact that, you know, when we harnessed fire and brought it around the campfire and we sang and we danced and we released those neurotransmitters that bonded us to each other, we became part of this very select group of species on the planet that are called eusocial. And so eusocial basically means that we need each other. We need each other to survive. And you know that with a baby can't live on its own. It takes years for a child to be independent in our species. Not all species are like that. But I think the combination of hearing this idea around this ability to create and to share our voices created these strong DNA connections. That chapter around community, talking with indigenous cultures, there are still 5,000 tribes today that use ritual and tradition to keep very fragile communities together. And that's extraordinary to me. Arts are personal agency. I said yesterday that they are the closest thing to what democracy means. It is freedom of your speech in the ways that you express yourself. And so I think the last takeaway is this idea that share your voice, find, share, and celebrate your voice in whatever way you do.
I mean, I'm amazed that as of January 2024, 57 million Americans report that they're having some sort of mental illness. That's like amazing. Surgeon General Vivek Murthy has talked about a loneliness epidemic. And what I'm hearing from you, Susan, if I'm hearing it right, is that the arts could really help with this. I mean, even like a little drum circle isn't something that's frivolous. It's actually quite important for connecting us.
There are creative cafes opening up all over the world. There are art nights instead of date nights. There are families that are deciding to have these art activities that are sort of separate. You know, you think about exercise, you think about nutrition, you think about quality of sleep. But we never think about the quality of an arts practice and what that does that's really different from an internal mental health but physical health perspective and how it actually ties us to community. And I actually think the numbers that you just quoted are underreported. You know, depending on the sector, we are seeing such increases in youth difficulty, but also in every single bracket, we're seeing mental health numbers surge. And I think it's really scary. I've been talking with the Surgeon General about these arts practices, and he's very interested in bringing more of the arts work forward. Arts creates culture, culture creates community, and community creates humanity. So it is a continuum that is so beautiful because each culture has their own ways to lift this up. So I also think it's about coming back to what's meaningful to you.
And speaking of what's meaningful to you, Susan, I would just want to come back to your twin before we wrap up here. Your twin's name was Sandra, is that correct?
Yep.
And she, is it fair to say she recovered from her accident?
Yes, she did. And she's actually a children's book author.
I thought so. She became an artist herself.
She did. And she writes a lot about connection and belonging and love and relationship. I know it came out of that experience.
And when she thinks back to that time when she wasn't able to find her words, like how does she describe it today?
It was a profound shift for her. It was the moment that defined her life. And she talks about this also. She's very clear about it being how she found her voice. And she became good at it, right? And she became, you know, extremely gifted in being a visual artist, but she also is a writer. She started as a visual artist 100%, but then she really became an artist author. I think what's beautiful about that is she continued to become a master. And I think we all go from interest to mastery in different things, and it's not necessarily art oriented, but she also really, I think, believes that it's not just that she became good at it, but it became her. It's really beautiful.
You know, you're out there in the world as testaments to what art can do for human beings. Do you hear from readers? Do you hear from other people about what art has done for them?
Thank you for lifting that up. The book has been really incredible to hear the impact. And I think there's three things that we hear. One is that the arts, the book validates what they already knew, that they were able to be validated. And that is not a little thing. You know, a lot of times we go through our whole life and never feel validated. Two, it gave them permission to make art again and to be able to start to be generous in their own use of making art. And then three, I think it's really served as a reminder of why they felt this way through the science. And so it's given them language, and people are using this for policy change, for curriculum change, for human resources. And so it served as a catalyst for taking what they already knew and validating what they knew to both do it for themselves, but also to do it in their work and in the world. And I think that's part of what's really driving this wind in the sail. But look, there are headwinds. Schools are still taking art out of schools. Performing arts centers are suffering. This is not ubiquitous. It's not sustainable. So we have a lot of work to do, but it's an army of the willing. And I think there are millions and millions of researchers and artists and arts practitioners who are aligning on this in all these different fields, but there's a lot of work to do.
So, Susan, how do we help with that work? I mean, how do we help teachers see that it's okay to take a moment to sing, to have a drum circle? It feels to me like often the schools clobber the arts out and take out creativity, what creativity children naturally come with. It's almost like by fourth grade, we beat it out of them. So what can we do to instill it rather than to lose it?
15 minutes for students across, certainly in early learning, and now we know through Ellen Galinsky's work, this critical periods in adolescence, using the arts for building neuroplasticity, for building brain structure and function is extraordinary, like nothing else. But right now, with the book and with the NeuroArts Blueprint, what we have developed is a strategy. The first piece is awareness, right? A lot of people don't even know that the arts are good for you. Not even a nice to have, just a waste of time. And so awareness is really important. And we've organized by sector to begin to start to work with all of the different organizations and individuals. And you're going to start to see more of a general public announcements and work because people are really getting behind that. And then moving into policy change. And so over the next 2 years, we're working with a number of people at the national level, but also regional and local level, hyper-local is where the action is. And so what you're doing in working in communities, communities can make the most change the quickest. So, but we're working across the continuum to really look at policy change. And it's going to be a public-private sector in this country. In other countries, there's a lot more money from the public sector to really help to bring the arts into some of these different environments, because they know that the ROI on the arts means you live longer, you make better decisions, you're healthier, so you don't need to rely on the healthcare system as much, and mental health is better. You know, we have a lot to learn from other countries, but the NeuroArts Blueprint strategy is really looking at how do you begin with awareness and then building that out into real systemic change.
You said it can help your health, it helps you live longer. I mean, these are like, we don't want them to just die in the conversation because they're just too important.
Yeah, we know through research that the arts help you with your physical health, with your mental health, with making better decisions, with actually helping with burnout and stress and anxiety. And so this is just thinking about 15 minutes of art a day in any environment will begin to help you really be able to regulate your nervous system. And we see the arts as neuromodulators, as ways to literally change your brain and body.
Yeah, I think that's powerful. And that gives us all a reason to go out right now and start doodling.
Speaking of doing something, Susan, we are coming to the end of our time here, and we always end the program by asking our guests one final question. And Kathy, do you want to do the honors today?
Oh my gosh, I would love that. All right, here it comes, Susan. What's one thing listeners can do today to make tomorrow a more promising place for every learner?
I think adopting an aesthetic mindset, and that's four things. Be curious, have playful exploration, explore the enormity of your sensory systems, and make and behold.
I love that.
So now you guys can see why I said that my friend Susan McSammon is the most creative lady on the planet.
Susan McSammon is the author of Your Brain on Art, How the Arts Transform Us. She joins us today from near an open window, which is something I think all of us ought to do a little bit more often. Susan, thank you so much for being here on Remaking Tomorrow with us. Remaking Tomorrow is powered by Remake Learning. Learn more at remakelearning.org.